The African remittance market is huge, accounting for over 6% of the continent's GDP. Azza Finance is one of the pioneers in this space, founded over a decade ago by Elizabeth Rosilio, a formidable American who relocated to Europe and then, having a chance encounter, moved over to Kenya before founding Azza Finance. Today, the company has raised over $50 million supporting businesses in 115 countries, grown from a currency exchange to a global fintech with expertise in frontier markets and currencies. On this episode, she shares her insights on partnering with fintechs and how she learned the hard lessons on ownership.
We had built up the same ARR in all non-Nigerian markets. So by June to December, we did $10 million of revenue from zero revenue Jan to June.
So pick up your headphones and tune in.
Welcome to The Startup Leap, the number one podcast interviewing startup founders who have taken the leap into starting their own businesses.
Here on The Startup Leap, we hear real, raw and relatable stories of these entrepreneurs, how they've navigated taking the leap and the decisions they've made. We're your hosts.
I'm Yvonne.
And I'm Maria.
And this is the Startup Leap podcast.
Yvonne and Maria are partners at Local Globe and OpenSeed VC, respectively. Local Globe and OpenSeed are independent of the Startup Leap podcast. Any statements made by Maria, Yvonne, or the Startup Leap guests are solely their view and are not advice. Endorsements by the Startup Leap, its guests, Maria and Yvonne.
Hey, super excited for today's guest. We have Elizabeth with us in the studio, and her story is incredible. I mean, you have come from the US, worked in the UK, and then built your company in Kenya. How did that come about? What sparked that initial idea?
Well, thanks for having me here today. It's been a journey.
10 years.
11.
Wow.
Just celebrated 11-year anniversary 2 weeks ago. Pretty wild.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. We say happy Azzaversary.
Oh, because it's Azza Finance Azzaversary.
Happy Azzaversary. But it's been a wild ride. You know, I studied languages in New York, and I thought I would just go to Europe. And I went to Europe to work in Germany and Switzerland, and I was already abroad. I didn't think I'd go further, but every time I think about a goal and then I get there, I'm like, what's next? And so I ended up leaving banking and went to microfinance, and that took me to Kenya. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Muhammad Yunus had just won his Nobel Peace Prize, and everybody was talking about it, and I was sick of traditional finance, and so went down to Nairobi. And
had you been to Nairobi before?
Never been to Nairobi. I didn't even apply for the job in Nairobi. I was like, I read Chinua Achebe. I was like, Africa does not need me. You know, I like made, sorry to the girls in my grad school that I made fun of. I was like, Africa doesn't need you either. I was such a like snob about it. I was like, because you're like, I'm going to go there and change the world. I'm like, really you? And so I applied for a job in Manila, and they were like, Manila's full.
Why Manila?
Because it was like the job with the title that fit my role. Mm. Literally
so
randomly.
You were open to...
Yeah, this company had like offices in Peru and Manila, in Lebanon. And I was like, I fit the role in Manila. Was leaving Zurich, just like go abroad. And they were like, how about Nairobi? And then I was like, what am I going to say to those girls in my grad school?
Got to go back to the family.
Tail between my legs, I joined the like arriving diaspora, the immigrants coming into Nairobi.
What year was this?
2009.
Wow.
Was wild. I thought I'd be there a year. And then I was just eyes wide open. Life began.
Incredible. And so 2009, how did Azza Finance come about?
So I spent 5 long years working microfinance. And when I say working microfinance, I mean every single month I was traveling to a new country to write a rating report. So like month one, they're like, go to Lilongwe in Malawi. And I was like, how? And they're like, the Paris headquarters would be like, figure it out. It's part of your job. So I suddenly learned about operations. I would do a trip to Malawi. Then I'd do a trip to Nigeria, a trip to Ghana, a trip to, you know, Mozambique, all by myself, you know. And then when you get there, you have to travel around the country and visit branches and, you know, visit the regulator, visit competitors. It was such an education. I don't know what I learned before I got to Nairobi, but everything started then. And so 5 years of doing that, and I just started to see a lot about the market. And I was writing a lot of research about it and talking to my good friends working in the space like Charlene Chen. And I came across a seed investor who was like, why don't you start something? And I'm like, no, I'm a researcher. Mm. you know, this is what I do. And he was like, well, why not be an entrepreneur? And I was like, I don't have that bone. And he said, there's no bone. And I was like, whoa.
There is no bone.
And Charlene and I would have like weekly lunches where we'd be like, why are all these like young guys showing up? No knowledge, no research, no field work, being like, I can change. Here we are with all this knowledge, all this data, overprepared. Sound familiar, ladies? You know, overprepared and, you know, underconfident. And this investor was like, just do it. And I was like, I don't know, rocket fuel. And then started the company, convinced Charlene to come join me. And there we went, 2011, wild.
So that was shortly after M-Pesa had launched, right?
Yeah, sorry, 2013, yeah.
So how did the M-Pesa, first of all, what does Azure Finance do, or what was BitPesa at the time? Could you explain what the company does,
sure,
just in a one line?
So at the time, mobile money was this huge thing, right? M-Pesa had started, I think, 2007. So by 2009, it was taking over. And my whole time in microfinance, we were seeing mobile money completely change the way banking was being done, especially in peri-urban and rural areas. We're seeing operating expense ratios plummet, right? No longer is it so expensive to do financial services across great distance. You can finally have remote financial services, something Europe didn't learn till COVID, right? So that was happening then. You also had centralized data systems that could be shared across branch networks and opcos, which was a big deal. So some small companies were starting up doing this, like CopoCopo or SimbaPay and things like this, but they were all domestic. Now, I was traveling constantly for my work, and so was Charlene. I had a drawer full of African money, and if you had, like, gone to the long way or Malawi, you came back and you're like, who wants to buy my kwacha? And people were like, you're stuck till next year when you go back. You know, like, who's going to Tanzania? Who has Tanzanian shilling? There was no way to change that money. So we were like, why can't we have the beauty of M-Pesa, which works so well domestically, when you're in Uganda, when you're in Tanzania? How do you have that interoperability? So the idea of the company, BitPesa, was really, how do I have the speed, the access, and the low friction of using mobile money across border, digital payments? And so we met someone who was interested in Bitcoin and told us a little bit about it. And we were like, hey, this would be perfect for what people need right now.
So you actually identified the problem before you identified like that Bitcoin could solve it.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much the reverse.
Which is the opposite of a lot of the market, right? Again, overprepared, overready, full understanding of the market. Doesn't sound like a founder, huh?
Good one. But it's very interesting that because 2013 and the crypto market then was, I mean, I feel like crypto and Web3 technologies with currencies have had several waves. And I feel like in 2013.
This was the raindrop.
Yeah, it was very, early. And maybe before we go into that, could you paint us a picture? Because I think that some of our listeners might not have the context of the backdrop of the FX transfer, liquidity, payments, cost issues that's unique to Africa.
So let's go back to it. So I'm traveling a lot for work. Everybody I knew was traveling a lot for work. Mm-hmm. If anybody was based in Nairobi as an immigrant, we were based there for regional jobs. So my whole community was like traveling constantly. And Kenya was having the banking boom. It was the financial tiger of East Africa. All of this wealth was being created. All my neighbors had these fancy cars and everybody had good jobs and, you know, it was really this amazing emergence of the Kenyan middle class. So you started to see KQ, Kenya Airlines, really develop with all this travel. So people are traveling for work. They're traveling for pleasure. All the immigrants are traveling around. Everybody's traveling, but it's so hard to buy money when you go abroad. And I would have the situation where I would go abroad to Ghana or Zambia and my card wouldn't work. And I couldn't get cash. And I'd be in a brand new country, you know, a little American girl, no money. Like, literally, how do I get to the hotel?
It's so funny.
Happened to me so many times.
2015, I lived in Kenya, and the same challenges. Coming from the UK, you just don't realize that I'm not going to be able to use my bank card when I go to Uganda. I'm not going to be able to use my bank card when I travel to South Africa.
Yeah, or you can use your bank card, but you can only take out, like, $20.
Yeah, or it doesn't even work across intra-Africa countries.
Even in Nigeria, it was all an inter-switch. So you couldn't, it was Verve card.
Yeah.
So nothing worked. You'd have to bring cash.
Exactly.
This sounds bonkers. You'd stop outside the airport on the side of the road and you do a money transfer.
And it's bloody expensive as well.
Oh, yeah. I remember the first time I went to go see, what's the startup that does all the Andela.
Yeah.
And we were like giving a speech to the Andela kids. And I was like, yeah, we haven't hit the money changers yet. And he's like, oh, let me call them in. And like calls on his phone and brings a money changer. And we go into a side room and we're changing money. And
done.
I'm looking at my friend. I'm like, we're the same people. And we come back out. And like then we went to take an Uber to go get the money driver. And the Uber driver's like, I don't know where it is. And he's like, you sit behind the wheel. I get behind the steering wheel of the Uber driver while he goes with Amy, our old, to go change money behind. I'm like,
yeah.
People don't understand what we're doing.
Like, so much friction.
It's like liquidity. There's not enough of FX in the market across the board.
We'll start one with, there's no interoperability of technology. Okay. To this day, 11 years later, MTN has different systems in every market to this day. Mm. UBA can't trade across borders. Today, 2024, still the same situation. So no interoperability of technology. Secondly, you don't have matching FX on either side.
Yeah, in terms of liquidity,
when
right?
We have the buyers and the sellers are completely kept separate.
Okay.
And we know.
So it's fragmented,
on purpose. Mm. Politically, business-wise, it makes sense for the powers that be to separate these guys so you don't have a fair market. So if you were to use technology to attract different customer segments, small value, mid-size businesses, B2B, P2P, all of a sudden you have more people trading, now you get that low price. Mm. Now you get what we call liquidity. Mm. You know, people say liquidity and
well, how
don't
much
know
of
what that means.
That is an availability of liquidity or an inefficiency in the market.
Well, liquidity is a direct, you know, relation to efficiency in the market, right? If you have an efficient market, it's liquid.
Mm.
You know, if you don't have an efficient market, even if there's buyers and sellers, it's not liquid, right? Got Think in. About secondary stock shares.
Yeah.
You know, if there wasn't a website where you could sell your Facebook stock before Facebook was public, you wouldn't be able to sell it. Now you had these platforms called second market.
Yeah.
And you could sell private company shares.
Yeah. The reason why I say this is because I think recently even Nigeria has seen like a 40% like decline in the FX exchange rates. And with some African countries much more than others, there's just not enough FX like to trade one way or the other. So for example, there's probably oversupply of Naira in the market compared to like dollars. So even if it was there, it's hard to just get that.
This is where I'll disagree with you.
Yeah.
It's there. It's being misdirected.
Mm.
And I'm going to stop right there.
And it's why you're so much on the black market.
Yeah.
It's there.
Okay.
It's there.
So you believe the liquidity is there. It's just the inefficiencies of the market. That's
not all.
Do you
believe the Nigerian diaspora wants to invest in its country?
I think they do. I think there's a lot of... Yeah.
Do you believe the largest energy companies in the world are investing in the country?
To some extent.
Do you believe there are people... It's there. Yeah. It's there. It's there. Now, yes, is Nigeria a net exporter of the main ingredient?
I think that's the,
main ingredient in its home dish.
Yeah.
Are they net, importer of tomatoes, which is important in every dish?
Mm.
Yes. However, there's enough liquidity for a lot of transactions that's not being captured. Is it perfectly matched?
Mm. Probably.
Kisa. Only the Lord knows.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more liquidity that I
completely agree with. And is that, so with the concept of, Aza, which was BitPesa at the time. And I imagine the Bit and the Pesa was like a play on Bitcoin and M-Pesa. Was that it?
Yeah, 100%. And actually everybody says, oh, you got rid of the Bit. No, we opened a Nigerian office and they hated the Swahili word.
It's like, let's be inclusive.
We had like Naija Kenya fight like showdown. How dare we use a Swahili word when our margins are better?
Yeah.
And then we had Francophone Africa, which didn't like Pesa either.
Yeah, so it was just to kind of like make it more.
So we were like, okay, let's rebrand. And people were like, oh, it's such a strong name, but Pesa, everybody knows you.
Yeah.
First in the world.
Yeah.
First in the world to trade Bitcoin against mobile money. First crypto exchange run by a female, all-female team.
Amazing. In 2013.
Yeah, I'm like goosebumps saying it.
Yeah.
It's me.
Yeah, I love it.
And Charlene and Amy. And then first ever to trade against an African currency. So mobile money, African currency run by women. And they're like, why would you give this brand up? But we came back with Aza, which we thought looked like a currency symbol, AZA.
Oh, I see.
And was like in a word in a lot of languages. And, you know, you do the marketing thing where they're like, what was your favorite color socks when you were in kindergarten? And, you know, they're like,
that is oddly specific.
How do you feel about the color as you're, you know, they're like, oh, no. you know, and then everybody votes and it's so random.
And then they find, you know, we land on something, yeah, or like, okay.
Like five campaigns ready to go. And then some intern goes, what about Azza? And everybody goes, yeah.
That makes sense.
I'm really curious. I mean, as you were speaking about the liquidity, I was thinking you and Charlene didn't really have prior tech experience. However, you did work in prime brokerage. So there's a lot of parallels from that perspective. When you were starting out, what were some of the nuances that you had to consider as you're thinking about, you know, the basics of API integrations, yeah, Bitcoin, yeah, and actually taking this from zero to one?
Yeah. In terms of making one, many founders don't have a technical background, and even a lot of men. So number one. Two, Charlene had a CS background. She has a CS degree. Mm. That's computer science for oldies. That's what we used to call engineering. She has a CS degree. Three, I Googled. You know, I can pretty much feel confident now that I'm in my 40s. I think I can say it out loud. I'm pretty capable of learning anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you just put your mind to it. Now, am I writing the code for the entire company? No. But do I run the engineering product team with Callum, our CTO? Yes. You know, I think you could just learn a lot. And some work said to me, like literally last week, he's like, are you technical? And then the thing he explained was so not technical.
There is a bit of condescension to that word, actually.
He's like, do you know what an API is? And I was like, do you? Because you're talking about it like it's something random. So I think I was just fearlessly, unashamedly asking questions.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know this. How? And I had a really cool friend, Spencer, who was in the tech hub with us, and he sat across from me and was very patient. And I was like, what about this? How does this work? What does this look like? So we were based out of iHub in Kenya. Yeah. Mm. And we met with this little crew of Bitcoiners once a week for a Bitcoin meetup. And then there were a lot of technical companies starting up, and everybody was really patient. We asked a ton of questions. And then we just had a really great communication with our first product team and our first engineers.
Did you recruit those first engineers?
Yeah. Yeah, I had this guy from Germany who was visiting and hanging out at iHub, who's into Bitcoin. Mm. Boomy, I think his name is Michael Boomin. And he came and built our first prototype. Amazing. And then we worked with this really cool product design studio called Circle in Nairobi. It was like a Kenyan British team. And they built our first UX. And it was just really collaborative. And we just did it together and learned along the way.
I'm so curious, in the early days, how did you think about your cap table? Because it's something that we don't often talk about, but incentivizing individuals, early team members, is so important. So how did you think about distribution equity in those early days?
This is a very, you know, touchy subject. Because like when we started, we got this check from this like rando investor guy who was giving out 50K checks. Later on, I realized he was only giving out 50K checks to women. Mm. I'll let it there. Let that go there for another podcast. But at the time, I was like, cool. You know? All right. And he's like, yeah, if you do something with Bitcoin, I have one in health, one in fintech, one in Bitcoin. So we were like, yoink, took that check and ran with it in our own way. I don't think he realized how self-possessed Charlene and I were. And we had, you know, more than enough on our own to do it. So we just did it our own way. And he did a 60-40 split.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then my ex-husband at the time said, you should be lucky you got that.
Oh, no. Okay.
That was the mental space I was living in then. Like, oh.
Is it like,
give me a crumb.
At the time, did that come off as odd to you? Or was it like, oh, we just need it? Or was it more, yeah, no red flags? It just felt.
I mean, I had been raised in investment banking. I expected no good treatment. Mm. I had no idea of my self-value at the time. I was at rock bottom. I had just had two kids right in a row within 13 months in a foreign country without any support with, you know, working in microfinance, which is not a wealthy job. And a lot of the consulting jobs that I was up for were telling me no because I was pregnant all the time. And though they would come to me, and I talk about this a lot, they'd come to ask me to give a presentation to their new office. Can I meet you for lunch? Can I pick your brain? Over and over and over and over again. How about you send me that spreadsheet? Until finally I got wise to it. And my best girlfriend, who just pinged me coming into here, was like, you're a diamond in the rough. She's from New York too. It's my neighbor in Nairobi. She said, stop giving away your intelligence for free. And you could do this. So I really thought I had a low value. Mm. And I think that's just, you know, story of my life. Every time I get somewhere, I'm like, oh, I can go more. I can go more. Oh, well, I can go more. And every year of this business, we were like, Charlene and I would like hold hands and be like, we could do it. Mm. And, you know, let's try to channel the confidence the guys who are starting these companies with no brain cells are. Mm. And we're like, even today, you know, I meet someone and they're here and they don't know what we know. Mm. You know, we're partnering now with bigger companies. And when we see what's inside them, my team is like, for real?
How did you get here?
For real? Yeah. Again, overprepared, you know, completely overeducated and undervalued.
At what point did you realize that that was a problem? And did you try to recapitalize the cap table?
Exactly what I did. So over and over with baby steps, I clawed back a little bit. Okay. Brought another investor. That investor taught me a little bit more about venture capital. I would speak with the portfolio. They would introduce me to other venture-backed companies. Now remember, I was in Nairobi. So there was like the guys in the iHub and that's it. And a lot of the Nairobi fintechs at the time were bootstrapped or had one uncle. And they weren't raising any money. And they didn't have visas to go to the U.S., so a lot of them didn't. Mubwana Ali was the only guy there from, like, Savannah VC. And he had 500 startups money, and he acted like Steve Jobs. You know, he was like, you know, like the overlord, you know. You know it, Mubwana, if you're watching this. And there was no one to teach us what was normal. So when I started to go pull to San Francisco to meet these guys or New York, I was like, there's a whole conference about VC investing. There's a whole cap table program. People would tell me what they were getting in Korea and in Europe. And I was like, what the, you know, what did I do? And then I slowly tried with each investment round to be like, let's give more equity back to the team. I still didn't make it that far. I still have, I think, way less equity than a lot of other founders have. And we had two secondaries and people took money out and we were told we weren't allowed. So 11 years and now I'm a single mom supporting three kids. People have made millions and I wasn't allowed to. So it's like been a rough journey. And I think that's the first thing I say to any founder that comes up to me, which is like value yourself. And you think you're here and everybody's up here. But as soon as you get there, you look around and go, this is what's up here. You know, this is what's above the glass ceiling, you guys. So, like, just know that now and have that value for yourself.
That's super powerful. And I think it's something that's not spoken about enough.
Yeah, because when you speak about it, they're like, shut up.
Yeah.
Or like, shh, or she's mouthy, or she's difficult. But I think at this point, 11 years in, you're like, who cares?
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the product and how you went from B2C to B2B.
Yeah.
Because you identified the problem from a consumer use case. But then there's a huge market for businesses and liquidity and FX.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that transition. What did that look like?
So first up, we were like, how can we use this friends and family? You know, my cousin was working in rural Western Kenya and he was like, great, I can take my M-Pesa into Bitcoin and buy dollars. Put in my account in an hour. How else could you have taken Kenyan shillings from a remote area and put into your U.S. bank account within an hour? Impossible. So we had that up and running 6 weeks after we started because it was so easy to hack into M-Pesa at the time. M-Pesa put a stop to that 18 months in, but at the time it was like, wow, this is so exciting. Then we started to realize that other countries didn't have fast payments. You know, not to make a pun, but the U.K. didn't have faster payments at the time. So you couldn't just top up your Bitcoin. It took like 4 days, which you might as well go to Western Union. So Charlene was going up to London a lot. We would like hand out barbecue at the Kenyan churches. We sponsored the Kenyan football team in Stratford. We did some real retail marketing. The things we did is so funny to think about it now. And
what was a crazy one?
We had an Bitcoin ATM in a church. I'm not joking.
Oh my gosh, like pay your tithe with Bitcoin.
In the back of the church, there was some free space. Charlene she doesn't get enough credit for being the negotiator. Everybody thinks she's just the like sweet, nice. This woman got this ATM in a church in East London. I wonder if it's still there. A Lamassu Bitcoin ATM for all the OGs. It was nuts what we did. But we were like, this is so expensive. We don't have any money. And it's so slow. So we're preaching to the choir. You can see these YouTube videos. We're like, use Bitcoin for remittances, P2P. But like, why would I wait 3 days? Now, it made sense coming from Kenya, but it didn't make sense rest of world. So that was a struggle we were facing to really scale. We had like, you know, $5,000 payments, $10,000 a month. I remember thinking, one day will we have $20,000 a month? And Joe Machero, who is the cabinet minister, ex-cabinet minister at the time, was the head of Google. He's like, one day you'll do $15,000 a month. You know, we're like, one day. And then I started going to Lagos. And especially when Safaricom started acting up, we're like, let's branch out. And we had an office sub in Uganda, but it wasn't as big of a market. So I head over to Lagos and I start networking, meeting people. And I met somebody who wanted to buy $100,000 worth of Bitcoin to buy 4 Dell computer systems. And at the time you could use Bitcoin on the Dell.com. And we did one trade and I was like, whoa. I learned about, you know, B2B wholesale. And I was like, never again retail. I was like, guys, what I'm seeing in Nigeria is so different. And then we were like, started to do for businesses. And I was showing up at the InterSwitch offices every single morning. I put my kids in the French school for free because they're French citizens. Made my mom move over from New York and live in 1004 apartments.
I know the 1004 apartment.
She was like, clearly I'd do anything for you.
If you ever doubted my love.
I would walk the girls to work and all the parents at the school were horrified that I would walk or I would take a keke. No. But I had to get to work and it was like traffic. And they're like, are you walking? And I'm like, my legs work. We're like less than a half a mile. So I'd walk them to school and then I'd walk over to InterSwitch or take a keke to InterSwitch and then sit in Mitchell's waiting room over and over. It's like a story you hear people tell, but it's true. And I kept showing up. I knew the security guard. I knew the secretary. And I was like, you will let me integrate into your API. And finally, after 3 months, they let me do it. So we're the first, I think we're the first non-Nigerian company to integrate.
Story of persistence.
And then we started seeing some real business take up. And then we're like, okay, this market's a little more on fire. And we don't have the monopoly of Safaricom breathing down our neck. So I was going to move full-time to Lagos, but it was hard to travel in and out of Lagos. The airport was bonkers. It was really hard to get in and out. And so I decided to be based in Senegal, and I would travel to Lagos for a week every 2 weeks. So I started to live this crazy life where we opened up a Nigerian office. I was there 2 weeks a month and also starting the Francophone office at the same time and just going. I even won first Endeavor Entrepreneur Award was me.
Oh.
And then I ended up quitting because I was like, I have freckles and I don't even live in Nigeria. This is not appropriate.
Mm.
So I did a year and a half. I think GB was in my cohort, Tayo from Paga. And then I was just like, I'm not Nigerian. I don't live in Nigeria full time. This is too much. And yeah.
How did you navigate the transition of expansion, especially from East Africa to West? It's one that it's not easy to do, even now.
I talk about this a lot. Look, I'm not Kenyan. My kids are born in Nairobi. They think they're Kenyan. They're not. You know, we're immigrants. So we're used to being different. Mm. And that helped us. It made us really versatile. And I always say that Charlene and I are nomads. So we're always strangers. So whether we're strangers in a country we kind of know or strangers in a country we just got to, same skill set. And we didn't have any uncles to help us in Kenya. And I think a lot of people, when they start out, they rely on their network. And sometimes they rely on their network a lot. And sometimes, as you guys know, it's easy to rely on a network if you have a very strong person of power. But then it's a golden handcuff. And we have had relationships along the way. And then that person comes out of favor with someone and it flips the other way. Mm-hmm. So very quickly, especially when our first board member left Google and went into politics, we were like, yes. And then we were like, uh-oh.
No.
We were like,
can't swing either
we
way.
Were like, wow. No, we did not. I don't know what this meant. Yeah. So very quickly we learned that lesson. So we just tried to stay under and do it ourselves. And every time we opened up a subsidiary, we were the directors. And that's also why I kept moving. I got residency in all these countries. And so I didn't have to have a local partner. That seems insane. And when you talk to these guys that come in big or tell VCs, oh, don't worry, I'll have it there. No, you got that in that country because you knew somebody or it's a family member or it's a old employer. But you're not going to have that when you go to Zambia. And you're not going to have that when you go to Cote d'Ivoire. Mm. So what's your plan? Now, when you tell that to a San Francisco VC, they go, oh, he's African. No idea. That message falls apart somewhere over the Atlantic. But that is the single biggest reason we have a truly Pan-African company that's as strong in East and West, Franco-Anglo, Southern, you know, Sub-Saharan and Northern than almost any other fintech.
Given the nuances of every African market, what was it that you think has led to as a finance success within the markets?
We had a years-long struggle to create what we called market entry, you know? And it was like,
oh yeah,
Charlene and I were good at it because we were gonzo, you know? I was like, I'm going there with my kindergartner, you know?
And it takes a certain amount of crazy to be able to do that, really.
And like, I think even that Charlene and I came to Nairobi so early and we left our, you know, that's hard to replicate. We are truly one of one crazy people. But like, we had a couple of early employees who were like that, Pushy Yen and Stephanie Zhu, also nomads who had come from China and Taiwan to Nairobi, similar. And we were like, how do we replicate this? How do we tell someone not to rely on their networks? How do we tell somebody not to do what they did before, but do something different? And so we tried to make a process for it. And it failed for a couple of years. We're like, okay, a big research report, and let's look at the World Bank data and come in. And then we're like, let's name the top 20 fintechs of a medium size, and let's go to the mid-sized banks. And I don't want to tell you exactly what our special sauce is, but we worked on it for years, and that was the toughest team to hire for. And now that team is full of people from the market. And that's what I'm most proud of. We like got a lot of young people, and we're like, forget what you learned before. Don't rely on favors and this and that. Rely on brains, relationship skills, incentivizing, partnerships. And we really think about this team so much. And it's the core of our business. When people say, how did you get these licenses? And we just got the Nigerian payment license Tuesday, by the way.
Congratulations. That is not an easy license to get.
It hasn't been public. I don't know when this is airing. It's probably after. But I've seen it.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was a big news Tuesday, 6 years. Wow. So we have two licenses in Nigeria now. What a journey. And like, how do you get the licenses? How do you get these bank accounts? How do you keep them open? Because it's one thing to get them, but then it's to keep those channels healthy, keep those arteries flowing. That's another skill. So as an operator, you learn to identify these special things that people sometimes brush over, especially if you have an engineer or a product person as a founder. They're going to obsess about the UX. They're going to obsess about the wallet, but actually you don't necessarily need to do that. I could spend all day thinking about the colors of my website. Sometimes I'm like, I don't want to look at it. I don't like the current version, you know, because I can't spend my time there. Other people can do that. What you really need to do is think about how your business runs and how do you grow it. And that's something I think founders have not paid a lot of attention to, or maybe been restricted by getting help in places where they started.
Yeah, I think that's so important, because as an investor, when we're investing in African companies, we often do want them to expand across various markets. And that's not easy at all. So you sharing the ways in which you did that is super helpful for our listeners. Now, I know that obviously you started out in 2013, but the market has evolved a lot since then. There's a lot more competitors than there was back then. You've been quite acquisitive in acquiring a number of companies. I'm just curious how you think about competition as the market has evolved and how the acquisitions have played some part in helping you overcome the competition.
Tim Draper is one of my shareholders and has been a great mentor. And what he said to me was, don't even waste your breath naming your competitor. Someone has built said, brick by brick.
There are people who share this sentiment. Some people believe, you know, you have to use that as research. Some others are like, don't focus on that. Focus on your customers. They will tell you about the competitors if it comes up. Is that your view as well?
Both my parents are college athletes.
Okay. So you are competitive.
I'll start with that. I'm from a family of five. All five of us are AAA types.
Wow.
I have been described as the most competitive person people have met. You know, I am very competitive and I am kind but can be savage, you know. So I have that fire in me, but I actively turn it off. And when the team is like, look what they're doing, I'm like, don't post that here. Get that off this channel. Mm. You know, don't put that noise in my Slack. Because, and now it's easier to say 11 years in, this company reminds us a lot of that company. What happened to that company? And this company is the same as that company. And guess what? We've seen all these competitors before 7 years ago. Now I sound like grandma. And are they making the same mistakes again? Yes. Is there something truly unique about this competitor? No. Out of your mind. Mm. Are they chasing our tail? Are they nibbling at our toes? Do they keep putting us in their pitch deck? You know who you are. You know, are they always at events trying to, you know, cream our light? Yeah, but brush them off, because we haven't seen, and this is something truly surprising, and I'm not like speaking from hubris, we don't have a direct competitor. We have people who compete with some aspects of our model in certain markets at certain customer segments, but not across. So they might take small value clients in Senegal in one certain segment, but then you don't see them in the other segments. And they're definitely not in Ghana or Nigeria. We might have in Nigeria a lot of Bureau de Changes, BDCs, who take the small checks, but they can't, they don't have the licenses to do bigger remittance or payment companies. And South Africa, you have someone might do collections, but we're one of like three companies that has the inbound license. So sometimes we see a lot of noise online, and that makes the junior employees nervous. Oh, they posted this and they did this. I said, and that means what? Mm. That great post, that good picture translates into what? Do they have a product? Are they going to take money out of our pocket? No. Who cares if they have bragging rights? And just with this Nigerian payments, people are like, let's post it. And I'm like, why? For who? Who are we targeting with that post? Are we targeting other regulators to tell them to hurry up? Are we targeting clients? Are we targeting people we want to hire? Don't just put it out there to make you feel proud. There has to be a reason. And if we stay focused, then don't let that noise distract you.
I love it. I love this perspective, actually. I'm curious on how you navigated not just intra-Africa expansion, but beyond. Because I think right now you're in 60 countries and you trade in 80 currencies. Could you tell me a little bit about how you made that transition beyond just Africa, starting from Kenya to Nigeria? And then also talk a little bit about the acquisition and if that played a role in how you thought about the expansion.
So from day one, people wanted dollar or Canadian dollar, or dirham, or yen with their Kenyan shilling. So day one, we were cross-border. Yes, they also wanted to buy Naira with Kenyan shilling, and one of our biggest trades was, year one, was interswitch Nigeria to interswitch Uganda, and then interswitch USD. So immediately, we were always cross-border. And then it was really demand-driven. What does the customer want? We went into Francophone. They wanted more euro. That's when we bought Transfer Zero, which was the Spanish company with the European license.
So you
license.
Let the customer demand drive.
Yeah, we were broke. We've been broke. We're still broke, right? Broke people only
innovate.
Act out of necessity. You know, someone's like, oh, I want your personal pledge. I'm like, I'm glad I give off money, because, you know, glad that's what you're getting from this. But, you know, we make decisions based on necessity. And I think when we came to the UK, we got our license in the UK through Charlene's chutzpah, as we say in New York, like literally her mailing with paper. Imagine that, millennials, mailed with paper to the FCA our application, and we got it. We had no money, and big fintechs were coming into the UK with like $100 million rounds from Goldman Sachs, and we did it with nothing. So that's how we got that first expansion to the UK. But when we heard about Brexit, and when we were in Francophone and we needed euro, we're like, maybe we should buy a company. And then one of our good people who comes from Poshi, who comes from that market development team, identified a client of ours and was like, this client has a license, has an incredible couple people on their team, has these connections, could give us exclusivity in Morocco. And it was a no-brainer. And similarly, E4F, which we bought in South Africa, was a client of ours and came to us again through Poshi, shout out. And, you know, it was like, this has all the things we need and all the things to plug in. And we bought it. It was an incredible acquisition. And we bid against WorldRemit, Zeps, for that. Mm-hmm. And we won. So that was clutch to our entry. I think also, like literally this week, someone was like, you know, I could partner with you, or I could build it myself in a year. I hear that.
Oh yeah, you'll
every day. Yeah. I think every day I hear that, and I'm like, oh yeah,
go ahead, try. Yeah.
We tried for years to get into South Africa, and then we're like, we have to buy it. And again, we're cheap, So we only buy where we have to. But that was, you know, sometimes you have to put your ego aside and sometimes you have to buy into the market. And sometimes you can build it. Sometimes you don't have time to build it. And so I think we try to come at every decision clean slate, no ego. What does the data tell us? Not this bravado of, oh, I don't want to pay for anything, or, you know, I can do anything they can do. Well, maybe not, you know. It's just like a cooperative approach.
I love it.
And how have you thought about revenue diversification? Because certain markets may be bigger than others. How have you intentionally thought about diversifying your revenues across markets?
We learned this the very hard way. We always knew we would diversify, but when the money's good and the revenue's good from one segment and one market, I always say it's really hard to take the needle out of the arm. And we were like, guys, we need to diversify from Nigeria. We really need to diversify from Nigeria. Let's do more integrations in Senegal. Let's try to go to Ghana. And engineering, products, sales, marketing was like, sure, sure. How about this new Nigerian client? And the margins were so great, you know? And we had a lot of VCs be like, oh, we love you, but the Nigeria exposure. And we were full of ego and full of, yeah, it might happen, but later. And then sure enough, the market crashed Jan 2021. And our dear ex-CBN governor, Emma Fili, was decided probably in the middle of the night to send out a text or a tweet or whatever that you could no longer use the Nigerian Naira to pay remittances and payments. And with that little note, everybody got kicked out of the market. And TransferWise and some others were named. And most companies exited the market. And we went from a couple million dollars a month revenue to almost zero. That was a tough board meeting.
I can't imagine.
And I was like, this is not Wifio. You know, like, we're fudged. It's over. We're not there. This can't be the end of us. And we were just like, let's turn the lights on. Everywhere we said we were going to turn the lights on. And we had realized we hadn't done enough planting. You know, we had not done what we thought we had done. So we raced. Quickly, let's open up these markets. Quickly, let's go into Ghana. Let's hire specialists in Francophone and let's finish this acquisition. And in 6 months, we had built up the same ARR that we had in Nigeria in all non-Nigerian markets. So by June to December, we did $10 million of revenue from zero revenue Jan to June. Wow. And that was an insane year. And it was COVID. I just had a baby. It was wild. But we had been prepped for it in that our team was ready to stay together and do anything necessary. And now we have some real strict rules about diversification. And people constantly say to me, what's your biggest market? And I say, all of them. We really try not to see one market run away. Now, of course, we're in FX. There's times when there's a really good ARB, but we try to be disciplined about it. And we have very strict risk controls. And we have a risk committee at the board. And I have everyday risk reports. And the whole company is now about diversification.
I love that. I'd love to talk about the team. You've mentioned Charlene. How did you meet Charlene? What was the origin story of the team? And also, how has this evolved over time? Because I think there's the nuance of building a regulated payments company that has cryptocurrency as its, you know, some of its infrastructure. There's regulatory nuances, there's partnership nuances, and you've talked about licenses. How did you think about the team in the beginning and how did that evolve?
Well, I'm Italian American, so I always go with people I trust.
Love that.
It's important to me. If I don't trust you, I can't work with you. And someone said recently, I read that what is true teamwork? It's about trust. And I've learned to build that. We have an internal coaching team we work with, and they've helped me build that with people that I didn't know as friends before. But in the beginning, Charlene and I were friends. We met through her old boyfriend and cast him to the side and kept it moving.
Thank you.
Thank you, next. And it's been a glorious relationship and so many ups and downs. And at the time, she was really good in things I wasn't good at, and we started that out. And we brought in some early employees like Amy Ludlum, who really helped. But she was like, after 2 years, she's like, that's enough. So you have to realize that sometimes people change, and there are people that are good for different times, and some people are lifers, and some people are for good stages. You have the scale up person, the expert person, the fly-in savior, you know, maybe you have a consultant that comes in. But I am not the same person I was 11 years ago, and neither is Charlene. And she moved to the board a few years ago. I think that was a great move for her. She took some time off. She did a lot of things. She actually has Operations Nation now, which is doing really well, and runs this family office. And I think we had to see, what are the skills for a bigger company, and what are the skills for a CEO and a COO now? And how do you run a company with 7 offices globally and that's constantly fundraising and constantly doing media? It's a very different experience. So I think just be open for what needs to happen at each stage.
What tactics did you leverage to weave the fabric of the culture? Did it emerge as an eventuality to who you are? Were you a bit more proactive about it?
And well, how has that changed as well as the company's evolved?
Early days, I had a 1- and a 2-year-old when we started this. You know, and like no help. I mean, I had a nanny, but I'm the mom. So my kids were in the office a lot, and we worked at my house a lot, and I would take naps in the middle of a meeting, or I'd be like, meeting's over, nap, and I'd close my eyes. And Charlene and Amy always said, like, I'd be sitting on a couch like this and be like, okay, guys, we have 20 minutes. I'm going to just take a nap. Close my eyes. And they were like, is this what motherhood is like? Like, they were so scared. But I was just open about it. Or I was like, I have to get on. We took a Boda Boda. I lived in Karen. I was like, I got to get on the Boda Boda at 5 because sunset's at 5:45. I don't want to be on a Boda at night. I got to get home to my kids. The nanny can go home so she is not on a Boda at night. We're just very respectful of each other's time. Like, I'm not going to make my nanny be in danger. I don't want to be in danger. And then I'll just get back online when they go to sleep. And I was just constantly open about it. So it gave me a lot of flexibility, and that made other people feel flexible. And our first employee, Shiko, who I told you about, ended up leaving the company after a few years. She had 2 kids and has come back to the company, you know. And I always say one of my first PAs, Judy, is now that one of a senior account managers, and she handles our mega clients. She's had 3 kids.
People are growing within the company.
Yeah,
we
grow together, and we have been through it. You know, we have been some rough times, and you know, we recently just had we had a reduction in force. We've only ever had that twice, and it was really tough. And people stay with us and they keep working and they're devoted. I think the culture came from, I had been treated so badly in other companies, you know, sexually harassed, you know, verbally abused, you know, my work taken from me.
This is from the investment banking background.
Everywhere. And I think you guys probably say most places. Now, do we know it's happening at the time? I meet some women still at women's events, like, really? That still happens? I'm like, do you know what's happening? Or is it really not happening to you? And Charlene and I would meet and talk about it a lot. And we were like, we don't want that for this company. So we've been just very open. I also am Italian American. I used to have the team over for dinner a lot. Gave everybody Christmas presents for the first couple of years. And then when the team got big, I'm like, how do I buy? What am I doing here? You know, we send birthday, you know, we really like bake that team. And Charlene knows every detail about our early employees. And we sat and work with them and snack with them. And, you know, I'm very informal. I think, you know, a Nigerian startup guy is like, you're eccentric. I'm just open, you know. And I don't think people always see that. They see me as like tough negotiator or very sharp tongued or, you know, very brisk. But with friends and family, my kids and the team, I'm very open. And we started to do a lot of like traditions, like offsites or, you know, team traditions of icebreakers. And that just stayed with us. And then I think year 4 or 5, we brought in Beautiful Soul, which is the name of this incredible coaching company, husband and wife duo, out of Senegal, and they changed my life. And I got personal coaching. Charlene got personal coaching. All of our execs got coaching, and they started leading our offsites. And that went from, you know, whatever I could muster to what they could do. And they took us to another stratosphere, when I tell you, another stratosphere. And I really struggled to trust my team. And Beautiful Soul came in, and they did these like mushy mush trust exercises, and I was an all guys team, and they were like, oh, seriously, Elizabeth is a robot and these guys, and they broke us down, and we were hugging, and we got to this level, and now these guys are ride or die, you know. And so sometimes you need to call in for help.
I love that. I got a coach last year, and it's been transformational. Everyone should get a coach. It's so valuable.
Yeah. And
the right coach.
Exactly. So I did a year or two with Patricia and then a year or two with her husband, Guillaume. Totally different. Mm. And then now we do these really cool things called tripartite. So if you're struggling with a manager, you can call in a coach and you basically have a safe space to do a triangle discussion. And it helps juniors feel empowered to say what they need to their managers. And we have diffused bombs, ladies, when I tell you the things we've diffused with this simple communication strategy. So it's been really awesome to teach the team to communicate across cultures and across borders.
You've done 2 billion transactions.
Yeah, even more.
Even more. 11 years. I'm curious, did you know that this was going to be the outcome when you started?
If I told you that in high school, I thought my career would be secretary.
No.
Foreign language secretary. That to me was,
and that was
like,
why you studied languages, yeah?
Guys, I knew nobody that was, I grew up in Queens. Like, that's not a nice neighborhood where I grew up in South Queens on Jamaica Avenue. You know, every single person was an immigrant. You know, my parents were teachers. They were the like elite of the family as public school teachers, state school teachers. And, you know, we had one aunt who was a secretary at AT&T and she was like glorified, like, Aunt Marion is a secretary. And I was grew up being like, wow, you know, like literally Mad Men style. And then I was like, well, I'm pretty good at languages. Maybe I could be a foreign language secretary. And everybody, and I went to like one of the best high schools in New York and they're like, no, I'm going to be an investment banker. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm like, I'm going to be a foreign language secretary. And they're like, can you like up the ante, Elizabeth? And I was like, well, I don't know any people. I don't know people. I'm from Queens. And then like I did a program at the UN where they had foreign language translators. I'm like, oh, that's enough. And people were like, really? That's your goal? And then like the summer after high school, I temped and I was a foreign language secretary as a temp, as a senior in high school. And I'm like, uh-oh, I've already achieved my goal. Like what's next? And then in school, I got into politics. And then in grad school, I saw people going to investment banking interviews all dressed up. And I'm like, where are you guys going? They're like, oh, don't you know about investment banking? I'm like, what's that? I literally didn't know what investment banking was at like 21. And this is what happens when you don't have role models and you don't have examples. And all these people that come out and say, oh, I revolutionized the banking sector when I was 20 with a project. Your dad taught you half that, or somebody. How the heck do you even find out about that? You know, this is like pre-internet, but still. So when I went to grad school and I went to the School of International Affairs, I met a lot of people from abroad, and a lot of people at SEPA at Columbia are from central banks. So they have central bankers come back to grad school in America. Mm-hmm. So from Kyrgyzstan, from Dominican Republic, I met central bankers. I met monetary policy people. I really met all these different careers. And I was finally opened my eyes to like what was out there. But then I needed to pay off my loans. So I went into investment banking to do that. But when I got there, I was like, these guys aren't that smart. You know, they're just mean and powerful and maybe I don't want to have a career where I'm mean and powerful, you know? And even now I'm doing a deal process and the bankers are like, you're great at this. I was like, yeah, I could be a banker. You know, I'd be a great banker and I'd be a really effing awesome secretary. But who knew I could do this? And that's what I tell a lot of people. You don't even know what you're capable of. Just keep readjusting the goalpost for yourself.
Were there any resources you went to or people? Or because there's the notion of having to skill yourself as a founder. There's a lot you don't know. And then you hit a wall and you're like, I need to learn this. You said this earlier. There's nothing you can't Google. How did you skill yourself? Where, you know, there were gaps, you brought people in. How did you continue to just up the bar?
Constantly asking questions. I am the person when I'm driving, I stop every 30 feet to be like, excuse me, where is this? Like, I'm shameless, you know? And when people then like, oh, you're dits, or they make some sort of thing. And I'm like, I am. I don't know anything, you know? Like, I give it right back to them. So many people are afraid to look dumb. I know I'm not dumb. My ex-husband used to hate when I said that. He's like, how dare you say that out loud, you know, without shame. I'm like, why? Everything else is against me. Can I at least say that my parents gave me some brain cells? Am I the smartest person? No. But am I dumb? No. Can I at least get some basis of self-respect, you know? So then why am I worried to ask a question, you know? if I'm asking the same question because I'm not listening and I'm being rude, that's one thing. But if I honestly don't know and you have time to help me, why not? And, you know, I give back to the world and other people. So as long as there's an exchange of information or help or friendship, we should be able to do that. I think a lot of people don't do that. And sometimes I get on the phone with young female founders and they're just pouring questions out. And I'm sharing, you know, I'm giving back. And so that's a lot of what I did. The second thing that really helped me, and this was a total factor of privilege, was that since I was in the crypto space very early on and I had a lot of press, I think month one, a girlfriend of mine wrote a Bloomberg article about me and it went global. That's how I found my first global investors. They were like, we saw you in Bloomberg. Somebody from my mom's group. Yeah, yeah. She's like, what are you doing? I heard you stopped consulting and now you're starting a startup about Bitcoin. She's like, hilarious. And so she's like, wrote this thing and it went viral. It was wild, like first viral thing. Month one, we just had the prototype in there. Like, thank you. And we got called by Barry Silbert out of the blue, like in the movies. Found me on LinkedIn. And he runs Digital Currency Group, which was the biggest at the time. We were his third check, his fourth check before Circle, like literally early, early days. And they invited me to New York. And I went to New York. And again, I had a US passport, no problem. So because I was in crypto, because I was American, and since I'm a New Yorker and he's a New Yorker, he bought my pitch in a way that other people hadn't. And he liked my hustle. And once they invested, he would bring me to these portfolio events where I would meet founders. And that was a huge education. Even now I'm friends with founders that I met through that portfolio event. And they would have this incredible portfolio advisor. And the first one was Meltem. And she's like very popular in the crypto space. And that's how I met her. And then they had Sam Bobo, who's also my friend, meeting her for drinks later. And they really helped match you together and answer questions. So I think when you have a fund that has that, that's such a good resource for founders, especially from emerging markets.
Now, I'm curious, if you look at the remittance market today, it's worth over $50 billion, accounts for over 6% of African GDP. However, fees remain high, averaging 7%. What does the future of Azure Finance look like?
So since we started, remittance costs have come down. And one thing I find very interesting is that the really big remittance companies, the big oldies, won't name names, are now moving over to what the challenger remittance companies are doing. They're buying wholesale. They're trading direct. They've stopped using these decades-long contracts with the big banks. That's changed just in the last 3 years, even the last year. We would not see them interact with us. All the challenger remittance companies, we had 34, would trade with us. And the big ones were like, no. And we're like, you're losing out on price. You're losing out on product. And now we've seen them finally come over the line. A decade it took. So that's one thing to see lowering price. We're also seeing a lot of companies like Wise say they want to bring it down to zero. You know, so what other products are they going to get that margin back on? So maybe remittance will go to zero, but then customers will be immediately lured into lending. You know, that's number one. Number two, liquidity matching. So we used to have small companies, high net worths trade with us. We're now matching with some of the biggest corporates on the planet, the biggest energy companies, the biggest e-commerce companies, the biggest payment companies. People are coming over to fintech. A lot of it happened in COVID, but a lot of it's happened just out of necessity. And you're seeing those traditional players that held those monopolies on pricing and those cartel pricing not compete. They're not attracting talent. Nobody wants to work for them anymore. Working inside of them, they're losing the talent that they have because working inside of them is just like toxic and old-fashioned and difficult. And their management is not realistic about what the market looks like. So VCs used to tell me year one, year two, even now, well, the banks will come. The banks will come. No, there's a lot of problems in the banking sector across the continent. Number one being it's so fragmented. You have 54 or 55 markets that you can operate in. So that challenger is not coming from there. And since fintechs have entered the market, the big remittance companies realize they have to become more like fintechs.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Now that we kind of come to the end of the conversation, I'd love to ask some retrospective question.
Okay.
If you could go back to when you started as a BitPesa at the time, now as a finance, and you could tell yourself, maybe you and Charlene, something, 10 seconds, something you needed to hear at the time, you didn't know then, but you know now. Doesn't need to be anything that changes what you do, just a little token of your future self to your past self. What would you say?
My number one piece of advice to myself every day is she who shows up wins. Just keep going. And it's never with you. We would always joke about that. Like, it's like you think it's over. It's fudge, we're over. No, it's really not, because there's always a way out. If you think it's the end, you're like, there's no way out of this one. There is. There is. Just keep going. My board said to me last week, they were like, how did you pull this out of a hat, Elizabeth? You're a magician. And I'm like, I don't even know anymore. Things just happen because I show up. And the fear that it's going to end. Every day I would wake up and be like, this is it. Today is the end. And I met a really big founder from MCOPA, Jesse Moore. And I see him at like some fancy thing. And he's like, oh, Elizabeth, let's have a coffee in the corner. And he's like, oh, so stressed. I'm like, you too? Like, et tu, Brute? Like, you too feel like tomorrow? He's like, yeah. And I was like, oh, no.
I thought at some point it ends.
So it only ends when you want it to end.
I love that. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Startup Leap, TSL for short. Leave a review, tell us what you think of this episode on all of our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guests. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.